This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Glynis Board. Some regions of the Mountain State are home to what is called karst topography.
For example, Slovenia, where I'm from, it's basically where the science of karst actually started, and the word is coming from there. It's the word kras.
We're going to learn about it and more on this West Virginia Morning. Stay with us. Environmental groups are raising the alarm over the financial sustainability of a fund that is used to clean up coal mining operations when mining companies walk away. Brittany Patterson reports.
Three groups, the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, the West Virginia Highlands Conservancy, and the Sierra Club, filed a lawsuit Thursday against the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection and its secretary, Austin Caperton. They argue the agency violated federal mining laws because it failed to alert federal mine regulators of recent major actions that impact the state's special reclamation fund. The events include the bankruptcies of Murray Energy, Black Jewel, and the possible bankruptcy of Southeastern Land LLC. Additionally, the DEP recently placed more than 100 permits controlled by coal operator ERP into a special receivership so they wouldn't be forfeited. DEP in March said transferring ERP's permits to the state's special reclamation fund would overwhelm it. Environmental groups are asking for a federal review of the fund. A spokesperson for the DEP said the agency does not discuss pending litigation. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Brittany Patterson.
Lawmakers in the West Virginia House of Delegates are approaching the needed number of signatures to call themselves into a special session, but such an effort appears to be dead on arrival in the Senate. As Dave Mistich reports, legislators are concerned with how Governor Jim Justice is spending federal funds in response to the coronavirus pandemic.
Lawmakers can compel the governor to call a special session by gathering the support of a three-fifths majority of each chamber. House Finance Minority Chair Mick Bates has been leading the charge in recent weeks and has often publicly questioned Justice on state spending without legislative oversight. Senate President Mitch Carmichael acknowledged that even one chamber acquiring a three-fifths majority is a rare occasion, but he said he doesn't support the effort to bring lawmakers back. While confronting Justice on spending federal aid money related to the pandemic is one priority, Bates and other lawmakers say there are many other functions of government that will need to be dealt with as soon as possible. He said the potential of the virus carrying on into 2021 leaves many questions on how the legislature will conduct its business. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Dave Mistich.
Health officials and researchers say the science is clear. Face masks can help reduce the spread of the coronavirus. But rhetoric from some elected officials has not been so clear, including among some leaders around the Ohio Valley. That's especially worrisome as the nation's COVID-19 cases hit an all-time high. Liam Niemeyer with the Ohio Valley Resource spoke with a former acting director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention about the importance of masks and the right messages.
Dr. Richard Besser is the former acting director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and is now president of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Besser was on the front lines as CDC director of a swine flu outbreak in North America back in 2009. And now he's offering advice to state health officials and regular citizens alike about the growing coronavirus pandemic. I spoke with Dr. Besser about whether there should be a face mask mandate and how the issue has been politicized.
But we are hearing mixed messages. I am hearing some Republican governors saying this as well. The Ohio governor was one of the early governors to shut things down in the state. I haven't heard his messages about masks. But it's very confusing to the public, and it's very damaging to the nation when you see divisions along political lines around public health measures. When I ran emergency preparedness and response at the CDC, we did everything we could to try and not create a partisan divide around what we were recommending. And early on, you saw that here at the federal level with the CARES Act, which was passed with almost unanimous support from both parties, providing supplemental unemployment insurance and eviction protection and payment to businesses, small businesses, to keep them afloat. It was bipartisan. And then since then, we've seen incredible partisanship, and it's really damaging. I'm trying as hard as I can to understand why some people don't want to wear masks and what that means to them when they're wearing a mask. And I want to have those conversations to understand that, because I think that it's a really important thing to do to protect the health of people around you. And when it becomes a political symbol, then I think we're in a really difficult position.
You mentioned the messaging regarding the Ohio governor. Actually, back in April, Mike DeWine, he originally announced a face mask mandate for retail settings, but the next day during his press conference, he went back to say it was only a recommendation. And West Virginia Governor Jim Justice had said recently he thinks face mask use will divide people.
First of all, it's almost impossible to enforce. And the second part of it is just this, is it will divide us.
From my perspective, there are real equity issues here. You know, when you look at the impact of the pandemic so far, every community has been hit, but some groups have been hit hardest. Black Americans, Latino Americans, Native Americans, lower income Americans, people in general who don't have the choice about whether they're going to work or not. And I think it's our responsibility to do everything we can to protect people who must be in the workplace.
Moving to a related topic, a Kaiser Family Foundation study from April estimated how vulnerable populations in each state were to severe illness due to COVID-19 because of pre-existing health conditions. And the Ohio Valley had the highest rates of vulnerability in the country. So how does that vulnerability relate to still rising case numbers right now in rural America?
So if one person is out working as an essential worker and gets the illness and they're young and they're healthy, they're going to do fine. Most people who are young and healthy do fine with this illness, but they may bring it home to somebody else who is elderly or somebody who has heart disease or lung disease or diabetes. There are very high rates of diabetes in Appalachia. So, you know, from a medical side, there's high risk. There are real challenges in terms of access to healthcare, as we've seen a lot of rural health facilities closing around the country. You see a high proportion of low-income workers who don't have the opportunity to work remotely from home. So these factors all combine to increase the risks in many parts of rural America. And the solutions to those problems may be different from the solutions that you're looking at in an urban setting. So it again points to the necessity of understanding the community and working with the community.
There was also a recent report by NPR that showed Kentucky and Ohio didn't have enough contact tracers needed for their populations. Simply, what are the implications of this?
Contact tracing, you know, is a critical piece as we move from lockdown to opening up. Because when you switch and say, okay, we're no longer going to be operating on this idea that everyone stays home except essential workers, what you have to have happen is what's happened in, you know, the approach that's used in many other countries, where you identify cases quickly. So testing available in every community, and you're looking at the numbers to make sure no community is being left out on that testing. And then once you find someone who's infected, you can very quickly identify who all the people they've had contact with, close contact with, so those people can be aware and they can be provided with services so they can be under quarantine in case they get sick. You know, it's a simple model, but each one of those pieces requires resources. And, you know, we've yet to see any of the states that have really seen their numbers come all the way down make the transition over to this yet. And it's not just having the number of contact tracers. That's really important. But you want those contact tracers to be from the communities in which they're operating so that there's a level of trust. What we're seeing in some places is that people don't want to tell the contact tracers who their contacts were.
I wanted to pose a listener-submitted question your way. This one's from Paula Gill, who submitted this one to West Virginia Public Broadcasting. So how often do you need to change a mask if it's only worn once every 2 weeks for an hour? So how often do you need to sanitize a mask?
When I look at the recommendations on that from CDC and others, their recommendation is if it's a cloth mask, it's a good idea to have more than one and to throw it in the laundry and wash it after each time of use. And you'll be able to see online recommended ways of taking on and putting on a mask so that when you're taking off a mask and if you throw it in the laundry with your wash, that's a good time you wash your hands because you've touched this mask that may now be contaminated.
Another question from a listener in West Kentucky submitted to WKMS Public Radio. This listener says they're practicing social distancing out less than 2 hours a week. How likely is this listener to get this virus?
Not very. You know, those activities that you're doing are very safe. The nice thing about being outdoors, if you're outdoors and 6 feet away from people, it's a really safe way to be, and it feels good. So I think your risk is very low.
Besser says individual decisions like wearing a mask can dramatically impact how many people will become sick or how many vulnerable people could die. He says wearing a face mask is ultimately about protecting one another, a small step that can make a big difference. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Liam Niemeyer.
Ohio Valley Resource is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. A mysterious underground formation that's key to the health of water may be in jeopardy. These ancient structures are found in many parts of the world, including West Virginia and Virginia's western spine, but they remain relatively unexplored. And as Robbie Harris reports, that makes them hard to protect.
It's called karst, a Slovenian word for a special kind of soluble stone, mostly lime and dolomite, that wears away over time, creating crevices, caves, and sinkholes. And that's where the mystery lies, deep in the ground.
It's a fantastic example of a sinking stream down here.
William Orndorff is karst protection coordinator with Virginia's Department of Conservation and Recreation, the only DCR full-time staffer on the project for the entire state.
So tell us what a sinking stream is for people who may not know.
Well, it's where you follow a creek or a stream and you're walking along and all of a sudden the stream disappears.
And that happens a lot when you drive the backcountry of Western Virginia. You'll often spot a road named Sinking Creek, because in this area of karst terrain, streams that flow on the surface for some distance will, at some point, just seem to stop.
And that's where you've reached a place where there's a connection between the surface and caves and conduits under the ground. And that water's found that connection, and now it's being captured into the karst aquifer.
That's where the caves and crevices, hollowed out over the millennia, hold water and support wildlife. But some are so small it's impossible to trace the path the water takes when it flows through them. And that makes it hard to find out what pollutants it might have picked up from agriculture or construction taking place on the surface, even miles away.
Unless you can walk through the cave or unless you've done dye tracing, you've lost that stream. You have no idea where that water goes until you do tests and studies to determine it.
Orndorff says fewer than 10% of these underground waterways in Virginia have ever been dye tested, and that's left cities and towns blind when it comes to construction projects and other above-ground activities that might affect the water below. Some communities have even built right on top of their watersheds. But in other parts of the world, karst formations have been studied for centuries and have been mapped and preserved.
For example, Slovenia, where I'm from, it's basically where the science of karst actually started, and the word is coming from there. It's the word karst.
Katarina Kosacvico got her PhD in karstology and studied at the Karst Institute in Slovenia, where karst is ubiquitous and quite well explored and mapped.
So since it's such a long history of karst research, they implement a lot of karst-related protection in the legislation.
Kosacvico works on a grant-funded part-time basis with Orndorff.
But the main differences are that the karst there, it's bare, so it doesn't have so much soil covered in here. While here, you can see that the karst, it's all covered, right? You can see just fields. You can see actual caves or cliffs that are made out of limestone, right? So it's harder to identify it here, and from that perspective, maybe harder to protect.
Sort of an underground, out of mind kind of thing. And the tiny fraction of karst waters this small team has been able to test suggests the problems may be bigger than we know.
Whenever we look, we find problems.
Again, Will Orndorff.
The things we've seen are things like the leachate contamination down in Lee County. We've seen industrial solvents showing up at springs up in the Shenandoah Valley. We've seen atrazine, a common herbicide used for preparing fields for planting. Atrazine is pretty much ubiquitous in the groundwater in the Shenandoah Valley.
Orndorff says in residential areas, different contaminants are often found.
You'd pick up personal care products, you'd pick up caffeine, you'd pick up various hormones. You know, whatever we put in the water, it doesn't disappear. It gets transported, it gets moved.
And that's the thing about water. It's always going somewhere. And as temperatures rise, as expected with climate change, water from the karst terrain will travel in new and different ways. We'll have more about that in our next report on karst and climate change. In Montgomery County, I'm Robbie Harris.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our news director is Andrea Billups. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm your host and producer, Glynis Board.